Platsmith, and we are ready to proceed on, I've got down Aaron's, oh, it's, the order's changed from my other order. Albrecht versus Fettig. All right. And Mr. Domina.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Again, this is Albrecht versus Fettig.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of Kevin Fettig and Fettig Cattle Company. This is a Uniform Commercial Code case, and I think it's worthwhile for us to pause to just think for a moment about an essential function of the code. The Uniform Commercial Code attempts to deal with disputes by reducing them in size, both in terms of people involved and dollars involved. Applying those principles here illustrates why the trial court committed error in its judgment below. This case involves an outputs contract that had to be filled with cattle that could not be identified in July as necessarily qualifying for the objectives of the contract, general objectives, identified by approximations at delivery time in October. It's also a contract that contains a limitation on remedies. When the cattle were delivered and the market had dramatically changed, a downward depression in the market by more than 20% in price, as is disclosed by how 10 additional head to the contract were priced, the purchaser decided to repudiate some 9 days before the deadline for delivery of conforming cattle. All of those points were missed by the trial court, and as a result, there was a reversible error, and Mr. Fettig didn't get the damages that he sustained. The contract here is an ancient contract. I think I saw the first iteration of this when I was a child, and it probably needed a rewrite, but it's what the parties chose. It does contain an awkwardly drafted limitation of remedies. I concede it's awkwardly drafted.
And it was your client who drafted the contract?
We supplied the form. That's correct, Your Honor. There's no question about that, and the rule of adverse construction toward us applies against us. I concede that point as well. We did choose the word, and the word approximate is a handwritten word in the contract that was assented to and negotiated for by both parties. So the form part we take responsibility for, the rest we think is bargained for. This is a contract to buy cattle to be fed in a feed yard. The objection to the cattle tendered is the color of their hide. There were essentially three specifics about the contract. Gender, they were to be steers and not heifers. Weight, they were to be approximately 780 pounds, and an approximate mix of approximately 20% red hides, 80% black hides. Apparently, the parties intending that they all be Angus.
So when you say approximate, what they ended up with was more like 60-40, right?
It was, in fact, even a little more adverse than that to us, I think 57 or 58%.
So is that approximate?
Well, no, I don't think it was. And so I agree that there was a variance with that part of the contract. Its materiality is an issue of fact. The court could decide that issue, and I'm not here to debate the materiality point. I don't think that's where our case lies. My contention is that because this was an outputs contract, we probably had a little room off 80-20. Not arguing it's 57%. But we certainly had an opportunity to either have the seller accept the conforming cattle and to substitute the remainder when we heard an objection to the non-conforming cattle, or we had an opportunity or we had a right to substitute performance entirely before the delivery deadline expired.
What was the explanation for why the 80-20 or somewhere at least in that ballpark wasn't delivered by your client?
There were enough red-hided cattle to fill the contract, but they were too light. So the decision that was made was that the cattle that were available were too small and that the approximate weight was more important in the industry and to the buyer than the color of
had
the
that,
hide.
Had that been discussed by the parties?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any evidence there had been a discussion about which factor was more important. We do know they were priced by the hundredweight. They were not priced by the color of the hide. There was no difference in price between the red and the black cattle at an 80-20 or 75-25 mix. That suggests weight was the more important factor. That's the best evidence we have of it. When we heard the objection, too many black hides, the response was, well, do you want me to come get the black ones? Well, give me a few minutes, I want to sort out what I can do. And the next word, which was again 9 days before the delivery deadline, was, you got to take them all back. And then when they were pushed back in our direction, it was sort of a conditional pushback. You got to get them all out of here, I won't take any of them, the market being down 20%.
Was there any evidence, though, that your client offered to bring more red cattle?
I don't think there was an affirmative statement that he would.
But isn't that a problem then, if you're in that, so the other party is left with, I either have a lot fewer cattle than I asked for, and there was testimony about the cost of feeding a lower number of cattle was not made up by the lack of cattle. In other words, our cost remains fairly stable, whether they're feeding 90 cattle or 150 cattle.
So
I guess that's my question, is there a problem there where it almost forces the other party to either accept fewer cattle or accept cattle that are not the color that he wanted?
Well, we think that's how the Uniform Commercial Code works, Your Honor, that where there is an acquisition of a commodity product, and that commodity product is only affected by efficiencies in the operation of the buyer that can be supplied by finding other commodities that fill the need, then there is no uniqueness, and therefore you must accept the conforming goods. If this was number two yellow corn, the fact that it was DeKalb versus Pioneer wouldn't make any difference. These are cattle. There is some argument, there is some evidence in the record, that feeding fewer is less efficient. That's true. But the way to achieve that efficiency back is to fill the yard. And there are other cattle out there with which to fill the yard.
Did your client indicate that he could supply those other cattle?
Well, we don't think he ever, as I said a moment ago, I don't think there's evidence in the record where he said, I will bring you conforming cattle. Because it was all about get them out of here, and the pressure was on trying to find trucks that were in Nebraska to take them back to North Dakota, which is a costly venture. And so it was all about, may I come get the non-conforming animals? The inference, we argue, was that there would be an attempt to supply the remaining animals. And there was a compulsion to do that because of the price. A significant compulsion to do it. Is there an affirmative statement in the record? I cannot say there is. At the same time, I can say that the buyer of the cattle didn't give us the opportunity. In fact, he held all of them saying, you've got to get them out of here, but I'm not going to let them go until you sign this ransom note for the cost of trucking them down here. So we think that the section of the code, section 2508, which talks about whether the conduct of the buyer is in good faith, is an important factor here, probably more so than 2719 or 2602.
But did he have the option of choosing that remedy under the code?
I think he did, Your Honor. I think he had to take the conforming animals, and he had to give us the remainder of the delivery time to fulfill the contract.
But I mean, didn't he also have the right to reject the entire load?
I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because that increases the size of the dispute between the parties rather than reducing it, which is all about how the code works. And that's how these competing, or at least transparently competing, sections of the code are reconciled. Thank you.
Ms. Ritter?
May it please the court, my name is Wendy Ritter. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Albright. I'm from Brock Law Office in West Point, and Mr. Albright is the appellee and the cross appellant. I'm going to skip ahead to prejudgment interest just so that if I can get that out of the way, and then I'll go back to the other part of the issues. Prejudgment interest was ordered by the district court in this case in its original order. Then a motion to vacate or amend the judgment was filed by Mr. Fettig, and we had a hearing And then, for whatever reason, the district court then did vacate the judgment and took away the prejudgment interest. I think the district court had it right the first time. The argument was that because I didn't allege and ask for prejudgment interest in my prayer for relief in the initial complaint, that I waived my rights to, or my client waived his rights to prejudgment interest.
Did you ask for it in the body of the complaint?
I did not ask for it in the body of the complaint. However, I did include a general prayer of relief that included all just and equitable relief under the circumstances. I would suggest that that falls right under the purview of.
But you hadn't put the other party on notice that that was an item of damage you were seeking.
It kind of comes with the territory, is what I would argue. There's also a case out there that says the prayer of a petition is not a part of the allegations of fact constituting the cause of action, and where the facts state a cause of action and are supported by the evidence, the court will grant proper relief, though it may not conform to the relief prayed for.
Did the court take away the prejudgment interest because he concluded that you had not pled for it?
He did not make any reasoning as to why he took it away.
Ms. Ritter, on that point, and I was looking for the name of the case, and I'm not finding it right here, but there is a case that is under the code pleading. The old statutes of code pleading that say, that basically says, if you don't ask specifically for prejudgment interest, you don't get it. And the language of that statute at the time is identical to our current rule with regard to requesting interest. So how does that affect our analysis in this case?
I think a lot of times you don't ask for post-judgment interest either, and that's oftentimes just a given. I would say in this case it falls under the general prayer of relief, all just and equitable relief under the circumstances. And then that gives the district court judge a little bit of leeway to decide what's appropriate. I'll move on to address some of the arguments of Mr. Domina. The two basic arguments of appellant in the brief were that he wasn't afforded an offer to cure, and this exclusive list argument. With regard to the offer to cure, there's three reasons that this offer to cure argument fails. First of all, and you talked about this, that had he picked up all the blacks, all 68 head of blacks that were delivered, which is what he offered to do, he would have resulted in further breach, because then my client would have been left with 92 head. And he contracted for 150 in the initial contract, and then he contracted with an oral agreement for 10 more head. So he needed 160, or he contracted for 160. He's left with 92. The same time, work, labor is involved. You get up in the morning, you feed your cattle, and if you're only doing it for 92 head versus 160 head, that just takes the profit right out of it. Secondly, the offer was made prior to rejection. The offer was made, or the discussion about the offer was made on October 15th. Mr. Albright was disgruntled. He was mad. He communicated that on the telephone, but then he said, give me some time to think about it and look at my options. Then on the 16th, he calls and he rejects the cattle, the whole load. And at that point, Mr. Fettig testifies he was angry and he shut down. And they talked about how to get the cattle out of there on the 17th. And from the 17th, October 17th, 2015, to October 25th, 2015, the phone records show there was no communication between the two. So if he's saying he could have cured it within that time frame, he didn't attempt to. He never called him. He didn't do anything. He testified he didn't look for other red cattle. He didn't contact the producer, the Mr. Call, to ask for additional reds, which were available.
How do you respond to Mr. Domina's argument that weight was more important here than color?
They're just all terms of the contract. I don't know how you decide what is better. If he wanted weighted cattle, you can get black cattle around here. The reason he went to North Dakota, he testified, was because he was looking for reds. And Fettig promised him he could find reds. And my client is a red Angus dealer. So he wants reds in his feedlot pens. He wants to show people he believes in the breed. So he went to North Dakota and utilized a cattle buyer to get reds. If weight was the most important, he'd have went to the sale barn.
Was Mr. Fettig aware of that, according to the evidence in the record?
Yes, there's evidence in the record that shows that they had prior communications. They even had a similar issue to this happen previously, where he promised him reds at a sale barn sale, and he delivered them. They were mostly black, and my client said, "I'll keep them this time, but don't you ever let that happen again." Come to find out, Mr. Fettig wasn't even at the sale barn when that occurred. The third reason that the offer to cure argument fails is that Mr. Fettig creates this new agreement in writing. It was referred to as a ransom note. Mr. Fettig wrote the note. He and his wife typed it up on the computer, sent it over to Mr. Albright on the day that the cattle were going to be loaded up, and my client's contribution to that note was that he signed it. He promised to pay the trucking. He promised to repay the $6,000 part purchase price to Mr. Albright, and then he didn't do so. My client promised to load the cattle up. He got a bunch of guys. They did it late at night, loaded them back up, and sent them. He followed through. The exclusive list argument, it doesn't really follow logic and common sense, in my opinion. The paragraph says that the cattle have to be in sound and merchantable condition, free of contagious disease, not crippled or deformed, blind-eyed, locoed, lump-jawed, or otherwise deformed. Under that argument, nothing about that, and my client agreeing to that, says that he waives his right to reject for any other reason. Nothing about that, the word only, is not included there. It's just missing. Under that argument, my client could have been delivered a bunch of Holstein steers, spotted cattle, and he would have had to keep them because they were in merchantable condition. And that just goes beyond what was contemplated here. Besides that, UCC 2-17, 1A and B provides that if there's an exclusive list, it needs to be clearly expressed. And the district court pointed that out as well. The long and short of it is Mr. Albright acted within his rights under UCC section 2-601A, and that's what this case is all about, that section. If the goods or the tender of delivery fail in any respect to conform with the contract, the buyer may reject the whole. And that's just what my client did, and he was well within his rights. If we tried to take other UCC sections and fit them into this puzzle, it just doesn't fit, and it doesn't protect people who are looking at the black and white letter of the law. And that's what happened here. He knew he had the right to reject the whole, and he followed the law. Had Mr. Fettig looked into it, he might have taken up that opportunity to cure. He just didn't do so. I want to talk a little bit about the numbers while I have some time. With the word approximately, that approximate number on the contract at, it's Exhibit 21 is the original contract. That number only applies to the number of head, 150 head. That was in a separate column, that word was, from the 80-20 red versus black. And I would like to point out, the expert witness in the case said approximately in cattle contracts, he had plenty of experience with cattle contracts, that means give or take a few. And Mr. Fettig was off by 40 head. That's not approximate. I would ask that this court affirm the decision of the district court in all respects, except for the prejudgment interest. And in that case, I would ask you to remand it to the district court to reinstate the order of prejudgment interest as initially set forth in its order. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Domina, how much time do we have?
May it please the court, if this were a case about deficiency at getting up in the morning, we'd have some evidence about Mr. Albrecht buying replacement cattle. We don't. This is a case that came about because the market collapsed and he had purchased above the market at the time of delivery. That's why it happened. Secondly, I'd encourage you to take...
Was that a question of fact for the trial court?
No, I don't think so, because the price here was fixed. The question is simply whether there was any duty to cover or attempt to cover or evidence of cover, and there wasn't. And so what that leads us with is this: Mr. Albrecht benefited from not receiving this commodity product because it was mispriced under the circumstances. Now that isn't bad, but it does impact whether he can repudiate or has to accept partial delivery.
Was that argument made to the trial court?
I think it was, yes. And I know it was briefed. I think it was. I wasn't there at the argument. I do have a citation I want to give you to take a look at, and that's Meyer versus Sand Hills Beef, 211 Nebraska 388. This is a case involving the purchase of an entire corn field. So the issue was when the corn crop was short, but you'd purchase the entire field and not bushels, was that an outputs contract? And I think that'll help you decide the outputs contract issue, which I think is where this really turns.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be taken under submission. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments, and you are excused.